Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. My name is Jamie.
And my name is Jerry.
And it doesn't get better than this show tonight, Jerry.
No, it doesn't.
Such a thrill for us to speak to the level of talent that we'll have on the show this evening. It's a big one for us. So we thank everyone for listening live or on replay in the archive. Just a programming note before we begin. We had previously advertised that tonight would include a tribute to Hal Ashby, the terrific filmmaker. With our interviews with John Voight and Ronnie Cox and Burt Young and a variety of other great talents. That has been pushed back to July 8th, Wednesday the 8th. And tonight, a little later on in the show, we'll be bringing on a great friend to the show, cinematographer Daniel Pearl, who, Jerry, you know this. If you talk about someone that has had an enormous influence, particularly in the world of music video, but film as well.
Mm-hmm.
He has worked with Michael Jackson on three occasions, including the Billie Jean video. And I really wanted to explore how Michael Jackson changed the music video form, because music videos have played such a role in shaping modern filmmaking as well.
Yeah, everything you see, like we watched something like an advertisement at the movie theater the other day, and you're just like, yeah, I mean, if it wasn't for Michael Jackson, that wouldn't be there. The dance moves and everything, it just wouldn't be there.
And he also had a film career he was working on, and we're going to have producer and screenwriter Rusty Lemerand on a little bit later, that was tailoring several film projects for Jackson that never came to fruition. So it's going to be a fascinating show, but this is exciting for us, this first segment here.
We have two great guests.
Yeah, amazing, amazing guests. We live in an age where the power of the image molds the global perception of the U.S. throughout the world more so than any politician ever could. And Hollywood is the largest and most influential purveyor of those images in the history of the world. But are they projecting the images that could heal divides and repair our good standing and win back the hearts and minds of those whose perception of us have dramatically been tainted? Those are the questions posed by Mike Medavoy and Nathan Gardels in their new book, American Idol After Iraq, Competing for Hearts and Minds in the Global Media Age. This fascinating, informative, and important work is a must-read, and you can purchase it now by clicking on the book's front cover icon on our homepage. Mike Medavoy has had one of the most impressive careers in Hollywood for the past four decades as Senior Vice President of Production at United Artists. He shepherded such projects as One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Annie Hall, and Rocky. As co-founder of Orion Pictures, he helped bring to the screen films like Platoon, Amadeus, Dances with Wolves, and Silence of the Lambs. And as chairman of TriStar Pictures, his winning streak continued with Philadelphia, Terminator 2, and Sleepless in Seattle. In his current position as co-founder and chairman of Phoenix Pictures, he's delivered movies like Malick's Thin Red Line and Forman's The People vs. Larry Flint, among many others. I could go on and on, Jerry,
yeah,
but the show isn't long enough.
Yeah, it isn't.
Nathan Gardels is the editor of New Perspectives Quarterly, Global Viewpoint, and Nobel Laureates Plus. His writings have appeared in the pages of the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, as well as dozens of international publications. And his previous books include At Century's End, Great Minds Reflect on Our Times, and The Changing Global Order. He is one of the world's most respected and renowned columnists on global affairs. It is a tremendous privilege to welcome Mike Medavoy and Nathan Gardels to Movie Geeks United. Gentlemen, hello. How are you?
Hello.
Can you hear me? Hello.
We're in good shape. I think Nathan.
Cool.
Yeah, I think Nathan just got off a plane from Japan.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't speak for how well he is.
I'm pretty well. Michael Jackson fever from across the Pacific.
I really appreciate you taking time out to do this for us.
We really do.
Thank you.
Incidentally, I don't know if you know, but I was Hal Ashby's agent.
You were, and you had involvement with Bound for Glory.
Well, Bound for Glory and Coming Home.
And you wanted to mount several projects for him later on in his career.
Yeah.
With Diane Keaton, I think was. I had read something.
Yeah, but, you know, Coming Home, I thought, both Bound for Glory and Coming Home were, you know, wonderful experiences for me. And of course, Shampoo, where I was his agent, was an interesting experience.
What an amazing talent that was. What amazing films.
Yeah. Anyway.
This book is fantastic. I urge everyone out there to read it. It's a very valuable book. And I can't wait to talk to you about it. Mike, you have often said that you learned about America from the movies. I know that you grew up in Shanghai and Chile, and I'm wondering what the movies taught you about America and how you think that differs from the way kids in those regions of the world view America through the movies of today.
Well, I think, I don't think they view it that differently. I mean, that was the point, and I think that was the thing that both Nathan and I talked about. I came to America expecting it to be, you know, like a movie set, you know,
mm-hmm.
with the refrigerators and the, you know, all the stuff that you couldn't get anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And it obviously all the dreams that I had came true in a very kind of strange way, because the, you know, fantasy became reality to me.
Right.
But I thought it was important for others to understand that's a great medium to not only deal with that, but to view our foreign policy and how other people view us.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And there really is, I don't think, we tend to live in such a bubble here in America, a lot of us do, that we don't realize the global reach of our films and our media. Nathan, could you give me some examples of how far that influence reaches?
Yeah, well, kind of in response partly to the question you asked, Mike, how things looked once and how they might look different, you know, depending on different audiences, because what we do in the book is we try to look at how American mass culture refracts differently for different people where they sit in the world.
Yes.
For example, I would say at the height of America's mass cultural power back towards the end of the Cold War, there was this famous radical Regis Debré, a pal of Fidel and Che, who said there's more power in blue jeans and rock and roll than the entire Red Army.
Mm-hmm.
Also today, if you're a shuttered Saudi housewife sitting there watching satellite TV, you can watch Oprah. And that has a kind of a subversive influence, you know, on that situation. On the other hand, if you're a Muslim woman looking at America, we quote in the book Queen Rania from Jordan, says many Muslim women looking at America think American women are desperate housewives seeking sex in the city.
Right.
So it's kind of a double-edged sword.
Right.
And, of course, in the Muslim world and in the Arab world especially, so many American films are seen as portraying Arabs and Muslims as bad guys, terrorists, are always in a terror context. But the reach of American media is so global that these images have great impact on all these cultures. And how you respond, whether you love or loathe America or a mixture of both, kind of depends on where you're sitting and how it cuts.
Right.
Yeah, but a lot of them feel, as a lot of people in this country feel,
mm-hmm.
that some of these films, they portray us as too permissive, possibly morally bankrupt.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they consume our films more than their own product, don't they?
Right. Right. Well, in the book, one thing we do in one chapter is we go through, again, going back to my point about how it refracts differently, we go through a chapter with four women around the world and how they look at American mass culture. One woman is a woman named Ayan Hirsi Ali, who wrote the book Infidel, and she talks about seeing, actually it was a film Mike made called
Secret Admirer.
It's kind of a high school farce type of movie, I think. But what she saw was boys and girls kissing each other or touching each other are interacting with each other very casually, something that she had never seen growing up as a Muslim in neighboring Somalia. And this had a deep impact in her life. What kind of world is this that's out there? I would like to live in that world instead of the world I live in. So that's one example of a film that was otherwise immemorable to most of us in the American culture, and how it affected her and how she liked it. On the other hand, we have in that same chapter, we have a woman who's the highest-ranking woman from the Iranian regime, the previous regime that was reformist, not even this hardline regime, who was the spokeswoman for the hostage takers that took the American hostages, who talks about exactly what you said. She looks at American culture. It's all about permissiveness and about selfishness and about the individual and not about God or about the community or about the spiritual life. And she looks at America and says, you know, in effect, this is the great Satan. There's no spiritual life in this country. It's bereft. It's materialism. It's all it is. So it depends on the different ones. And then just we have two others. I won't go all through all of the details, but Madeleine Albright, you know, also as a mother and woman as First Secretary of State, looks at films and says, well, sometimes they offend in Kansas as well as Karachi. And then Benazir Bhutto, of course, who was killed in Pakistan running for president, talks about how Pakistan is divided between Muslims who want to join the world and they love American mass culture and others who think that it's decadent and it's a betrayal of the prophet. So again, it's a double-edged sword. It's one of the points you try to keep making in the book. It's not just all one or all the other.
I was thinking, you know, movies basically, you know, if you're going to make a good movie, you know, it reflects life in some way, but it reflects life as it is right now, you know. And the movie will be released a year from now. And the character, you know, you build a movie basically, you know, through a story, but the story basically is the characters. So it's how you portray those characters that basically goes into how the story is portrayed.
Yes, sir. I think it was very telling in the book. One of those four people that you mentioned, Nathan, she has a quote here. Today the West doesn't have to deploy its armies and naval fleets, only its satellites and TV broadcasts. That is even a deeper threat to Islam.
Right. That was the Iranian woman who was the spokeswoman for the hostage takers.
I wonder how she feels right now, by the way.
Yeah, really.
She's a reformer.
With our armies all
line.
Over the place.
Yeah. How has... It seems like this is a more important issue to tackle than ever, particularly after... We're so embedded in Iraq. Is that a big motivation for writing this book?
You know, when Mike and I we were talking for years. You know, we would both travel abroad and we'd see this mass influence of or this big influence of American mass culture and wonder why it was not incorporated in thinking about America's role in the world by the foreign policy establishment.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about that often. And one time about three years ago, we had lunch and said, well, we should look at this more systematically, because it was right at the time of Abu Ghraib, you know,
Iraq.
The cover of the book has a painting by Botero about Abu Ghraib.
Mm-hmm.
And America's image was completely in the toilet at that time. I mean, still not out completely, thanks to Obama. I think he's got some traction for America's image again. But it was in that moment which we thought, you know, we've got this huge factory that creates images about America, because we're known not only for what we are and what we do, but how we project ourselves.
Right.
And it was being so low in the esteem of the world by all opinion polls, we thought this would be a good time to write a book about America's image, how it's shaped, how it's formed, how people perceive it, etc. That was really the motivation for the book at that moment. You're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to sell democracy or even the concept of liberty and freedom if you're not living it, if you're not basically showing it. It's also hard, you know, to portray, you know, every Mexican as a, you know, as a drug dealer or a drug, you know, runner, or every Arab, or, you know, as being a heavy. I mean, it's just, you know, nobody in the world is going to buy it. I mean, I just don't think you can sell it. And frankly, you know, people are sick and tired of the and this kind of two-face. You know, we say something and we don't live it. And I think that's another issue that I think we captured in the book.
well, what types of films would you like to see kind of change that perception? I know you talk a lot in the book about a film like Babel being a prime example of the kind of film that we should see more of.
Yeah. I always say, if I can answer first, because I like to use the example of Babel, and I hate to talk about individual films because everyone has a different take on a given film, right? This was too pretentious, or you know, whatever. But the way of seeing, when we use the Babel as an example, it's the way of seeing the film which was so important. Mm-hmm. That Alejandro González Iñárritu point that we need to, you know, see the perspective into the lives and the souls of others. You know, we need to portray them as not as cardboard cutouts, but as real characters. Mm-hmm. With real respect and real dignity, just as we would view ourselves. So not as kind of background extras, but as the world that we're really tethered to by globalization, what these anchored, you know, all these different characters. And Babel at least tried to do that with the Japanese character, the Moroccan kids.
Sure.
You know, obviously the stars that were in it, the American stars that were in it as well. And
you know, by the way, you know, we're not suggesting that films like Transformers shouldn't be made. You know, that's, or any, you know, I mean, you know, I was involved with Terminator, I was involved with RoboCop, you know, I mean, that's not what we're saying. I think that, you know, what we're saying is that when we do it, you know, when we do a film, is that we don't demonize, you know, just, and make stock characters out of those who we may have a problem with.
Yeah.
You know? Now, there was a, you know, just films people may be more familiar with, like Spielberg's Munich, you know, did try to show the, you know, kind of what's inside the mind of the, you know, the terrorist in Munich. It wasn't just, you know, the side of the Israeli athletes, for example.
Right.
And Stephen Gehagen's Syriana, it was a similar type of thing. Anything that shows the motivations through imaginative knowledge, we call it, it's like literature and cinema, that shows a character and the motivations and the kind of life a person is living. So there's a, you know, an understanding of other people that are different than us in this world. That's really important in the age of globalization. It's not going to get rid of conflict, obviously.
Yeah. Or, by the way,
conflict based on ignorance.
Yeah, and we don't, you know, we're not advocating that the government suddenly decides, you know, because we're asking them to be a part of the solution. We're not suggesting that they tell Hollywood what movies to make. You know, that's not the indication in the book, and it's not what we are advocating.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, going on that about the government, though, do you think there was like a tremendous opportunity after 9/11 for Hollywood to try to take a more responsible, make more responsible films in that regard?
I think it's very dangerous for us to say, you know, that we need to tell Hollywood to take a more responsible point of view.
I was just curious if there was any...
If they don't come to that decision themselves, you know, there's nothing that we're going to be able to do because,
right,
for all intents and purposes, for them and for anybody who invests in the movie business, which is, as you know, very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not only expensive to make it, but it's expensive to sell it. The key question, really, I think, is, you know, they've got to look long term. I mean,
right,
they've got to see that what's happening now is that people around the world want to have their own voices felt.
Yeah.
You know, the Chinese want to be able to do films about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And they want, you know, they have, you know, 1.2 billion people that you know, can go to the movies.
Right.
You know, and that's true around the world. I mean, we happen to be, you know, better at it. We've been doing it for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
We've created something that was basically handed down to us by people who really knew what they were doing. And you know, we're starting really, actually, when we at the beginning of movies through World War II, where the face of America was seen through, you know, movies made, you know, that starred you know, John Wayne.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, you know, the world is changing, and
mm-hmm.
you know, we've got to change with it.
Yeah,
one of the things we like to say in the book is that America, because others want to have their own myths and stories on the screen as well as America, this is the part about competing for hearts and minds. And the John Wayne era in which America could write the script for the world, both in Hollywood and Washington, is no longer there. Now it's a matter of competition.
Yeah. I think you say it in the book. You say, for some countries, the worry is not only that the dominance of American mass culture will eclipse its own, but that its damaging power to label others outstrips their own capacity to assert their identity.
Yeah.
I think that's very valuable. But even so, with government's role, this is a very hopeful time, in spite of all the trauma going on throughout the world, because we have Obama in the White House, and he is definitely someone who seems to be cognizant of the importance of restoring our image throughout the world. Mm-hmm. So how would you suggest that he engage the powers behind our popular media to go to the right direction?
Absolutely, I absolutely agree with that. Well, you know, in the book, we have a couple of recommendations. One is something what Hollywood itself can do, and what the government can do, and the State Department and public diplomacy.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are really two sides to it. One is projecting America's image to the world, and the other is projecting the world to America. And as far as the State Department and the government is concerned, I would like to quote, and I think we quote in the book, the former foreign minister of Germany, Joschka Fischer, who said, the role of a foreign minister was once to represent his country to the world, now it's to represent his world to the country. In a global world, which are all linked to each other, it's essential to have that kind of link. And our view is public diplomacy should not just be directed outward in projecting the image of America as a hybrid, plural, cosmopolitan culture of which Obama is the poster child. That's very important in a world in which you have ethnic cleansing or attempts at religious purity and so on. It's a very important message. It's also project the world inside. And America is, almost nothing is translated these days in books. Mainstream media has gone almost completely national, meaning unless a global crisis erupts quickly like Iran, you have to rush, speaking as a journalist, you have to find spare people around the world to cover the story because you don't have an infrastructure in place. So we need to replace that information about the world and knowledge about the world, and the government's important in providing that through institutions, universities, exchanges, and so on. Even translating books and doing films and other things. Trying to get exposure for foreign films, for example, or exposures for films that are particularly good about America that may not meet the mass market. But the main recommendation for Hollywood is that Hollywood, I mean, our concern about Hollywood, mine especially, since I'm not in the industry per se, is the incredible insularity of Hollywood. You know, images are so powerful, but the people who are, in many cases, writing the scripts and making the films have very little experience in life other than having watched TV and movies their whole life.
Creativity
take care of itself. It's just that people need to be exposed and educated to what's going on in the world.
I sent the book to a couple of people, who run studios, and some of them read it. Others said, well, I'll read it over the summer when I have time.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's not exactly a long book. And I'm not sure that they're going to ever comment on, what it is, what the message is, or even, for that matter, in some cases, understand it.
Right.
But, it's interesting to me because I think, what we want to do is to, at least make sure that we're heard. And, one way to do it, obviously, is to get people to pipe in, and people like you and others who, I've been on, seem to feel the same way as you guys have, indicated you feel.
I wanted to touch on something Nathan brought up about foreign films. There have been several over the years that I think of American audience watch, especially this latest one, The Stoning of Soraya M., which is very good learning, but, it definitely corresponds with what's going on in Iran right now.
Absolutely.
But there's another film several years ago that was nominated actually for Best Foreign Language Film, Paradise Now.
Right, exactly.
About the Palestinian suicide bombers. And
exactly.
I thought that was, just an excellent film, and actually a very well-balanced film. Forget the criticism that came with it, but I thought that was a very well-balanced film of what's going on in Israel right now. And I thought that was a good primer for someone who didn't know what was going on to really – that was a good way to learn what was going on in the situation. I think there's a lot of great foreign films coming from the Middle East that could really enlighten this country.
No, that's a perfect example, because in the book we quote a former director of National Intelligence for the CIA – talking about the dead-end mentalities in the Middle East, where things have gotten to the point of where it's zero-sum for either side, the Palestinians or the Israelis. No one wants to compromise.
Mm-hmm.
And this CIA agent looked at three films Paradise Now, which you mentioned, by Hani Abu Assad and Steven Spielberg's Munich, and I mentioned before Syriana as well.
Right.
Each one allowed you to step out of your own side of the argument and see, like in the case of Paradise Now, the doubts that were going on in the suicide bombers,
mm-hmm.
the social pressures. It gave you not a cardboard cutout of a terrorist, but the real emotional and experiential and existential issues going on with a person on that side. That's a great example. That's exactly the kind of great empathy that can be created by good filmmakers. That's exactly
yeah.
what
I think so, too. And I think it's very important, too, to be able to be exposed to films that inspire us to look inward and be a little self-critical and humble.
Yeah. In fact, we were having a discussion the other day on that point. Someone was asking, what film should be shown on 4th of July about how great America is, right?
Right.
And so we kind of flipped it and said, well, you know, the film you want to show, you don't want to show is The Green Berets, which was ostensibly a patriotic film.
Oh, God,
but it
yeah.
shows
no,
American,
you don't want
to say extremely arrogant American. Everyone else is a cardboard cutout, et cetera, et cetera, versus Gran Torino. Well, Gran Torino, where you have this crutchy old war veteran,
mm-hmm.
you know, bitter white working class guy, neighborhood filled with immigrants, and it shows the frictions, but also the compassion of this man to these strangers that move into his neighborhood. That's America.
Yeah,
that's a
right.
film. That's a 4th of July film. So
perfect choice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, Mike, your career has been defined by just so many movies that matter and that make a difference. And even a movie like a Terminator 2 or some others that you mentioned earlier, the commonality that they share is a humanity that I find missing from a lot of the popular genre pictures. So I thought it was particularly fitting but brave of you as well to put out this message in this book. So.
Yeah.
Very thankful that you have.
Thank you.
The book is called American Idol After Iraq. You can purchase it here on our homepage. And this being a movie show, I can't let you go without asking about just two upcoming projects that you have that excite me very much.
Both
Shanghai,
very much. Yeah.
Yes, Shanghai, which I know has to be a personal passion for you. What can you tell us about Shanghai?
Well, here's what I can tell you is that Harvey Weinstein bought this project, which I had developed 12 years ago. And he basically paid me a lot of money and said, okay, I'll make this picture someday. And 12 years later, of course, he went to make it.
Hmm.
He did not get the cooperation from the Chinese because the plan was to shoot in Shanghai. So part of it was shot in London and part of it was shot in Thailand.
Hmm.
Yeah, that had some restrictions on the story. I think Michael Hallstrom's done a really, really good job. Harvey's worked really hard at trying to get the best possible movie that he knew how to do, and he spent an enormous amount of money for that kind of picture to put it on the screen.
Yeah.
And for that, I respect Harvey. I mean, for all intents and purposes, once he bought it, despite the fact that, my colleague and I were somewhat involved and spent some time in it, it's been a difficult process. I think, it'll turn out to be a really good movie.
Oh, that's fantastic, yeah.
Now, on the other film?
Shutter Island, of course.
that is a terrific film, I feel really good about the performances in the movie and obviously the director and the script, Lita did a great job, with the book. And then Marty's directed, I think, a really wonderful film. And everybody in it is great.
I've watched the trailer about 1,000 times since it premiered. It's insane about Scorsese, as all of us are. Gentlemen, thank you so much for writing this book, and thank you for giving of your time tonight.
Yes,
this has been
very
fantastic.
Much.
Great. Thank you, guys. And
thank you.
Nathan.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night, guys. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, that's Mike Medavoy and Nathan Gardels. The book is American Idol After Iraq. If this conversation that we just had is any indication, it is an important book, an engrossing book, and as Mr. Medavoy pointed out, a short book.
Yeah, it's really not going to really take you that long. You could skip a day of work and read it. It'd probably be more beneficial for you.
Yes, yes. It's a valuable read, so I highly recommend checking that out. Okay, so we're getting geared up for our next segment.
Okay.
These moments when we're able to express to someone who's made so many films that have made a difference to us.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about third, like from the 70s on, I mean, just an incredible career.
That means a lot.
Yeah,
it means a lot to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because Cuckoo's Nest, I've always said Cuckoo's Nest is the movie that changed me more
mm-hmm.
than any other, or the first movie, you know, for me, and he was, you know, very involved in that one.
Mm-hmm. He was, and yeah.
I think something like 16 of his films have been nominated for Best Picture, and 7 of them have won.
Yeah, I mean, he's been, it's really funny, he's been at the starting process, he's had something to do early on with a lot of these films, you know, he's always at the gestation process of a lot of things, and very fascinating, and it's something to say something that this man was associated with a lot of these films that we grew up with, or even before we were born, that he's still in the game, he's a survivor, and, you know, we say a lot of stuff on this show, but to be a survivor in this business is an incredible accomplishment.
Right.
And still
right.
be, if you have those two big movies coming out this year, or that's testament to your strength, power, and intelligence.
And you can also purchase his autobiography, which is fascinating.
Which I have in my hand right here. You're only as good as your next one. So,
yeah,
and it's a very fascinating memoir.
You can purchase that on our homepage there, too. We're waiting for our next guest to call, Mr. Daniel Pearl, who's been with us before. He is the DP of the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which is near and dear to our hearts,
yes,
and the remake as well, which is the most beautiful horror film I've ever seen, visually,
mm-hmm.
from a visual standpoint.
No, he's got a great eye. He's got a wonderful eye, and we talked about that the last time he was on. But let's tell everyone why he's on tonight.
Well, he really made a place in the music video realm
mm-hmm.
Early on in his career. To a large extent, he defined the power and the influence and the art of the music video. He worked with some of the biggest acts, Mariah
right.
Carey, J-Lo, Janet Jackson, The Police with Every Breath You Take, and just on and on and on. Lionel Richie, if you look at his credits of the videos that he's done, especially for people in our age group, Jerry,
right.
he kind of defined a childhood for us.
He's one of the pioneers of the music video, the birth, really, of the music video, why they're important, why they became what they are. This man is definitely one of the engineers, architects, if you will.
Yeah, and I really wanted to bring him on tonight because, like I said at the top of the show, in thinking of how we could celebrate the work of Michael Jackson
mm-hmm.
as a movie show,
right?
Obviously, Michael Jackson was in The Wiz, and he had his place in film.
Which I watched every time it came on television as a kid, The Wiz. I watched it all the time.
Oh, yeah, of course. But also, how influential music videos were in the world of cinema.
Mm-hmm.
And how Michael Jackson was the most influential person in the world of music videos.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, a little later in the show, we'll be bringing on Rusty LaMorand, who wrote and produced Captain EO for Michael Jackson. And they maintained a relationship over the next 25 years, during which time Rusty was developing several movie projects for Michael Jackson that never came to fruition for one reason or another
right.
that he gets into. That was the one terrain, feature films, that Michael Jackson was anxious to start in, but it never quite came to fruition. So you'll hear a lot of great insights into that as well as we go on. So let's bring up our guest. I believe we have Daniel on the phone with us now.
Cool.
And talk about these great videos that he did with Michael Jackson.
Come close your door.
Hi, Daniel, are you with us?
Yeah, how you doing, guys? Hey, thanks
hey,
for the kind
welcome
words.
Back.
Very nice of you to attribute so much to me. Thank you so much.
Welcome back. We love you on the show, and we had such a great time talking to you about a year and a half ago, so we couldn't wait to get you back.
Unfortunately, under these circumstances.
No, I wish it was under better circumstances. I really do.
Yeah, but that was the first thought that came into my head to celebrate the work and the legacy and the powerful talent of this man in the way that we're able to on this show to bring you on to talk about your experiences of working with him on these videos. Videos were kind of relatively new when Michael Jackson came to be. How long had you worked in them before the Billie Jean opportunity came about?
Well, I had, Billie Jean was a few months after MTV started broadcasting on the West Coast. I'm not exactly sure when they started in New York, but I know it was 6 to 8 months later that they first broadcast on the West Coast. And we had been doing the quantity of music videos or promos or clips, whatever you want to call them. They were basically known as promos in those days in the early 80s. I started doing them in 1979 for a company called Kramer Rockland and a director named Jerry Kramer.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't do that many, but every 2 or 3 months or so we would do one promo. And it basically, there was a phenomenon or a statistic that the record companies were aware of. If you got a single in the top 10 in either England or Australia, where they had regular shows, Top of the Pops or Old Grey Whistle Stop, if you got a single in the top 10, if you put a promo clip on the show, which they ran on Saturdays, your album sales would multiply by 5x, and then the next week it would fall just to 4x, and then the next week to 3, to 2, to 1. So it was a pretty much guaranteed way to make money. So those were the original clips that were being made. And then MTV started, I think, in 82, I think it was. And then it became much more prevalent. We started doing a lot more.
Yeah. Well, Michael Jackson was certainly popular. Off the Wall was, as a child with the Jackson 5,
mm-hmm.
The world knew of him, and Off the Wall did very well. This was his breakout album. Do you remember the first meeting, the first kind of creative meeting you had with him concerning Billie Jean?
Well, the first time I actually laid eyes on him was when we were about to start shooting. We had lit the day before, and he'd come in to rehearse for us, and he had been through it, sort of showing us what he was going to do, and we pretty much got straight into it. I did. It is kind of funny for me to say this at this point in time. Before we shot, I said, all right, well, we're ready to shoot now. You're just probably going to want to go get your hair, straighten out your hair. And he goes, oh, no, this is my new do. So a little faux pas on my part there, and away we went.
Wow.
I do want to say, and as you guys know, I'm not sure if your listeners know, I tried to put you in touch with the three directors that I work with because, as a cinematographer, it's my job to realize their vision, and
yes.
I appreciate how much credit you guys gave me. But I'm basically at best I'm the right hand man to the directors who come up with the ideas and really the guys who drive these things home. But
they're all fantastic.
I am an important contributor, and I'm hoping that I don't know if Steve Barron, if you guys managed to speak to him or not, but I think that the when I read the concept for Billie Jean,
mm-hmm.
There was an epiphany of that this is not simply a performance. This is not a copy of an existing, a music video version of an existing film, which is basically what music videos were in those days.
Mm-hmm.
This was his own genre. This is something entirely new, and that was quite apparent to me at the time. That we were really pioneering ground here in terms of how we were telling the story.
It's like a mini film. It's a film unto itself.
But it has its own structure, and its own sort of language, really, its own way of telling the story. And the other thing that I want to say is that there have been two times in my career when I've been someone from the label has come up to me as we were about to start shooting and they told me how huge and important this song is going to be.
Uh-huh.
So we have to, you know, make sure you do a good job. Well, of course, we always intend to do a good job.
Right.
And I always approach every single thing I do with everything I have in me to make it as best I can. But Billie Jean was one of those times, and Police, Every Breath You Take was another one, right around the same time.
We have a question in the chat room from Free the Souls. That's his screen name, not his real name, I'm taking it. he wants to know how long the shoot was for Billie Jean.
It's quite some time ago, but I believe it was a two-day shoot. And
2 days, wow.
I think it was 2 days. Are you saying, wow, thinking it was more?
I would have thought it would be a lot more, but okay.
No, I'm pretty sure. You know, it was actually shot 16 millimeter. It was a pretty low budget venture at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I don't know exactly, but I'd say it was somewhere in the ballpark of $65,000 to $75,000.
Wow.
Which in those days was they were just starting to get some money. It wasn't,
right.
It certainly wasn't low budget. It wasn't big budget. Oddly enough, we sort of come back full circle and back to that sort of budget
mm-hmm.
again today.
But could you sense that form was changing with that video?
That marked the beginning. I mean, you could tell it. You could tell the song was going to be strong. Although it was early into it for us, we knew that the great songs made the great videos. As long as we, did our part, that it was a great combination. You got a great track.
Yeah.
Put together a good crew of filmmakers, and you're going to make a great video. And then, of course, at that time, it was important to me to get pulled into music videos. Actually, the director, Russell Mulcahy, he didn't direct Billie Jean, but he sort of brought me into mainstream music video work. He was a huge fan of the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
The Highlander director, right?
Sorry, excuse me?
The Highlander director?
Yeah, he's the Highlander director.
Okay,
yes.
Sorry.
He was, at that time in 81, 82, he was very much the guy in music videos. And like I said, he was a huge fan of the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, so when he needed a DP in Los Angeles, he had his producers track me down. We did Supertramp, It's Raining Again. He explained to me how this phenomenon, and this is maybe interesting to your viewers, why they're known as music videos, because they were absolutely in those days, and to my knowledge still today, are principally shot on film. But
mm-hmm.
there's a process called telecine, where we take the usually color negative film that we've shot and we transfer it to videotape. And as we do that, we can very much adjust the color, the saturation of the colors, the hue of the individual colors, the brightness of the overall scene, the darkness. We can really pick it apart, and it's not quite as thorough as one might have using Photoshop, because our images move
right.
At that time. But still, we had most of the basic same controls as Photoshop. And Russell urged me to understand was that he needed 64 setups for this song. And, it wouldn't do to have any less. And so he was telling me, you still have to do your job. I want you to do it to the best of your ability. But
mm-hmm.
I want to make sure I get all these setups. Well, to sort of make this long story short, I shot him his 64 setups. He invited me to telecine. I there mm-hmm. saw this amazing machine at work for the first time in my life. It still was not a very well-known device or technique, but it is basically also essential to the development of music videos, because what it did was it allowed us to very much create a look that might not have been possible if we didn't have this this technology at our fingertips.
Sure.
And also, it was huge in allowing the directors to edit these videos the way that they did. Because they took them out of analog editing. Well, they were still analog, but they were electronically editing rather than having to physically deal with the frames, which allowed them to be very much more experimental with their editing,
right.
And which basically is huge in creating the whole genre.
Well, you did two other videos with Michael.
One more thing I want to mention was that when we were done with this telecine, the reason I went into this whole story was Russell said, come with me, you did a great job, come with me. He took me to a party at the Chateau Marmont on Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles. I didn't even know this party was going on. And there were about a dozen of the English directors. Steve Barron was there, Godley and Cream were there, Brian Grant, et cetera, and basically presented me to the group as this is the new guy here in Los Angeles, at which time the producers started signing me up right away, and both Billie Jean and Every Breath You Take were a direct result of that.
I'm curious, when you worked with Michael that first time in Billie Jean, just observing him, what were your impressions? What stuck out for you?
You know, he was obviously he could move like no one else, and you know, and that was became quite apparent right away. Like, oh my God, you know, when he did his sort of rehearsal for us, we were all like, oh my God, this is incredible. You know, so we knew that there was something very special happening there. He was. I know you mentioned the other videos, and at that time, you know, he was pretty accessible. You know, we could speak to him, and you know, he was pretty much a down-to-earth, regular guy still at that point in time.
Yeah.
As we went on into the other videos, he became less and less accessible to us as individuals.
That is something that interests me, because you're in the unique position where you worked with him on three different projects, coming from three different albums.
Correct.
I believe Given to Me was next. Was that from the Bad album?
That was the next one I did, yes. I believe it was the Bad album. I'm not sure. But that was
and, the then, and then You Are Not Alone. And that might have been from Dangerous. I'm sorry if I'm not up. I still listen to Barry Manilow 24 hours a day, so I'm not. I'm not as up to date as I should be. But so tell me about that. What kind of differences you noticed as the star rose?
By the time we did Give In to Me, which I'm going to estimate was 93 or 94. I'm not sure if I have that right. Maybe it was even earlier. Give In to Me, we shot in Munich, Germany. Michael was preparing to go on a big European tour, so he was already in Germany rehearsing. Andy Morahan was the director. Andy Morahan, as well as a great director, is a dear friend of mine. We must have done 60 or 70 videos together, and a lot of the great ones, many of them, we did a huge, big bulk of well-known Guns N' Roses videos, and which we were in the midst of doing those at that time, and so this sort of became a natural, you know, collaboration, because Give In to Me is Michael with the Guns N' Roses band minus Axl, and so basically, you know, with Michael out front and Slash is up there right next to him, and Slash gives I think a fantastic performance, and overall, I really like this video. I think it's in many ways, you know, of course, it's got this bit of magic at the end where, you know, Michael insists that they do something that's, you know, above and beyond normal humanity. So he starts flicking lightning bolts or, you know, electrical bolts around the set. But up until that point, he's quite human and quite real and a real rock and roller, in my opinion, you know.
He is a rock god in that video, yes.
Yeah, he is.
I think it's fantastic. And, you know, for me, it's, you know, of course, having worked on it, I'm liable to be prejudiced, but I think it's one of his best videos for me. Now, unfortunately, that video may not have been seen by a lot of your listeners because he chose around that time he was doing an interview. I think it was a 2 or 3 hour show with Oprah Winfrey that was being broadcast worldwide, and at the time it was quite phenomenal. It was going to be the first time that a billion people were going to tune into anything simultaneously.
I remember that, yeah.
And they chose to premiere the video on that show. Now, this sort of, you know, got MTV's nose out of shape. I mean, MTV,
exclusivity.
They ruled music video with an iron fist, basically, and they wanted exclusivity. They premiered every video at that time.
Right.
And because they weren't allowed to premiere that video, they never really showed it a whole lot. You know, they bring it out only for retrospectives and, you know, things like that. But still, for me, it's, you know, like I said, I think it was a great video. Now, we shot that in Munich, Germany, in a abandoned railway repair building, factory, basically. It's like, kind of like a factory, but it's for repairs. And they had big big turntables where you could drive an old steam locomotive onto this track, and the track could rotate 180 or 360 to turn it around and get the train back out.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of different heights and levels to this place where Andy had us, build this sort of steamy kind of sexy, sex-oriented club, you know. Not over the top, nothing, too bad, but it sort of has a little bit of a dark side to it in my mind.
Right.
The audience does, and I think it's also very interesting because, you know, it's a little darker than Michael was going at that time, too.
I saw, I'm so sorry to interrupt, but I actually saw the Given to Me video played on MTV the other day, and I was so thankful, first of all, that MTV was actually playing music videos. I thought that was terrific.
Yeah, when did that start again?
But it was such a return to how extremely gifted this man was, and to view these videos again, and another one of their videos that they played, of course, was "You Are Not Alone," which that had to have been a unique experience for you.
That was
Michael and Lisa Marie, right?
Yeah. Yes. It was. Do I have a little time to speak some more on?
Yes, you do.
Oh no, I'm so sorry. Yes.
On "Give In to Me." Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
"Give In to Me," and unbeknownst to, I got this location, right? But what we weren't aware of was that there were Russians. You have to realize that the Iron Curtain, I guess, was just down around this time. They were bringing in cow hides by the truckload, which they were tanning there, which had this outrageous odor.
Mm.
That permeated the whole building. They actually installed a perfume system throughout the building for the time period that Michael would be in there. And we were working there. We spent that one. We had a two-day shoot. We had only 7 hours with Michael. And so we had we pre-lit, and we lit it very carefully. Has Andy Moorhan joined with us? Will he be speaking?
He never contacted me back, and don't see a call on the.
All right. I'll tell the story. It looked quite. You know, those of you who've seen it, I thought I did some interesting thing. I had some new lights that I'd never seen before. Some programmable small xenons that would actually, you know, be remote controls by a computer. I had, eight cameramen, eight operators working for me at that time with the director, and I had just finished everything, got it all tweaked up, and I was sort of showing the director, who was set up at the back of this massive big room we were in with his eight monitors, showing him all the various cameras, and we were playing a track, and we probably had a stand-in for Michael, and we were running the lights, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when it was done, he goes, "Daniel, it looks fantastic. It's really good now." He goes, "As soon as I have a word with Michael." Oh, and I should mention that Michael's manager at the time was sitting with Andy. And Andy said, "Daniel, it looks fantastic. As soon as I have a word with Michael, we'll start shooting. You're ready, right?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm ready. Let's go."
Mm-hmm.
So the manager goes, "Oh, no, Andy, I'm sorry, but you're not going to get to speak to Michael." Andy goes, "Are you crazy, man?" He goes, "Daniel, get ready to take it all down." Now, this is a million-plus video. I don't even know exactly how much, right? But,
mm-hmm.
You know, I'm told to be on standby and ready to give orders to strike the whole thing. We're not going to shoot it.
Huh.
The manager goes, "What are you talking about?" He goes, Andy goes, "No, under no circumstances will I shoot this video until I've spoken to Michael Jackson." He goes, "Well, all right. I can see you're serious about that. Hang on a second." The manager gets up. He goes away to go see Michael at his where he was, you know, he had a quadrangle of... RVs, excuse me.
Yeah.
He had a quadrangle of RVs that he had, four of them that were sort of set up, and with one way in and out of that led right into our building. And I walked over to Andy and the man. I said, "Andy, are you kidding, man? I mean, this is huge. I mean, this would be gigantic if we don't shoot this. You know, I mean, there's going to be lawsuits, all kinds of shit will go down." he goes, "Daniel," he goes, "the rest of my life, people are going to ask me, what was it like to work with Michael Jackson? What am I going to say? I don't know." So the manager came back. He said, "Okay, Andy, come right this way. Michael will have a word with you." Andy went away for about 10, 15 minutes, came back. He said, "All right, guys, I've spoken to him. I told him what I wanted him to do. We're good to go, and away we go." And,
wow.
And we went and we shot it. But it was pretty wild there, because he was adamant he was going to shut it down and not shoot the video. If the reason I asked if he was getting on, I was going to let him tell the story. But if he hasn't joined us,
Was there much conversation between Michael and the directors on these shoots? Typically,
no. In fact, going into Give In to Me, we were all told that you will not speak to Michael Jackson. You will not look at Michael Jackson. And for God's sake, you will not take his picture.
Almost a coward use, almost.
I said, I'm sorry, I must protest. My job is to take his picture.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't need to speak to him, but I do have to look at him, and I am going to take his picture. So anyhow, I was allowed to look at him. I was allowed to take his picture. The assistant director, a very dear friend of mine as well, a man named Ian Patrick, he was allowed to speak to him to tell him we're ready to bring him to and from the stage, but really was told not to look at him. So we went and we did it, and we got it done, and it turned out pretty well, I think. I think even Michael was happy with it.
Oh, it's a beautiful video. And also, before I let you go, I want to hear any thoughts you might have on that third collaboration.
Yeah, absolutely. So now comes time for the third video, which I'm doing with Wayne Isham, was the director on that one. And we get told that we're about to do this video. We're summoned to a meeting with Michael. We're going to go to Stan Winston. Stan Winston, who was one of the greatest practical effect makeup artists. That did all sorts of incredible makeup prosthetic pieces. He was fitting Michael for some angel wings. I don't think they really appear in You Are Not Alone, I don't think. But anyhow, we were going to shoot him with some wings on angel wings on his back. And so we were called to a meeting there to have a word. Michael's going to have a word with myself as a cinematographer or cameraman. He wanted the AD there. He wanted a producer there. He wanted a director there, the AD being the assistant director. So we went to the meeting, and as we're going into the meeting, he said, okay, you won't look at him and you won't speak to him. And I thought to myself, well, what kind of a meeting is this? So anyhow, as we came in the door, I didn't look at him. I looked down at the floor. I said, Michael, you may remember me. I'm Daniel Pearl. I shot Billie Jean, and I shot Give In to Me. He goes, you shot Give In to Me? I said, yes. He goes, he knows exactly what to do, everybody. Meeting's over.
Oh, great. Yeah.
So now, everybody walks out of there. Like, all right, we did stick around for another couple of minutes. But basically, he felt confident that I would do a good job on him and make him look good. And basically everything was going to be okay. He felt that everybody understood and respected his wishes, and we were going to take good care of him.
Yeah.
We go and we shoot him. First thing we did is we shot him in the theater. And this theater, I must say in this piece, that a lot of people, including one of my very good friends, Hype Williams, music video director, a lot of people believe that theater is CGI, that it's too pretty to be real. But I can
exactly,
tell you,
yeah.
It is not. It is not too pretty to be real. And it was actually I had a very good friend from film school at the University of Texas who was my chief lighting engineer, a guy named Jim Bogard. And it was his last job, and may have been some of his finest work that he ever did. Let it suffice to say, it is a real theater. We did light it. It was there. We were then to shoot. After that, the next thing we were supposed to shoot was Michael on a green screen, and we had painted one of the biggest three-wall cycloramas in Hollywood green and lit the entire thing. We had a motion control camera in there. The idea was we were going to shoot several sequences against green screen. And for those of you who are filmmakers, you understand the technique. I'll briefly explain it for those who aren't. When we shoot somebody against green, or sometimes called blue screen or green screen, because it's so far away a color from the flesh tone, we use that color blue or green. And if you're surrounded by blue and green, as you move, it allows us to basically use the green screen like a cookie cutter and cut the subject, the foreground subject, out and stick that subject on any background of our choosing.
Right.
So it's basically it's a frame-by-frame changing, moving cookie cutter that cuts out whatever it is we want to lift off of that in place. And in the case of You Are Not Alone, he's put in the Grand Canyon, he's put in the desert, in Mojave Desert, he's put in different places. Also, he's put in the paparazzi, where he's walking along the paparazzi in that scene.
Yeah.
With flashbulbs going off. One of the flashbulbs, while we were shooting that, actually exploded with a loud pop that sounded quite like a gun.
Ooh.
Michael doubled over at the waist when that went off. And my initial reaction is, oh, my God, I thought he'd been shot.
Oh.
Fortunately, nothing like that happened. It wasn't the case at all. But at this point, he was really not wanting to be around any more people than he needed to be. So anyhow, he chose not to show up the day we were supposed to shoot the green screen. And he notified us about 4 or 5 hours into the day that he wasn't coming. So Wayne Isham, the director, and myself, we were able to get time at the Telecine where we were working on the film, where we're going to transfer this footage to videotape for the edit, and to do that with a very well known today, very one of the top colorists, a guy named Stefan Sonnenfeld. Mm-hmm. And we went there right away, and we put up the footage that we'd shot on Michael in the Pantages Theater day or two before. I should say that I lit for quite some time to make Michael's face flawless. I lit out every unwanted fold and crease and what have you. Everything. I lit everything out.
Right.
A lot of light bounced off the white cards. It's kind of a thing. It's almost like it's like frosting a cake for a cameraman. When you light in this style, you're just basically reflecting, bouncing white back into the face, and you just drive light into all the problem areas.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, when the first footage came up, I went, oh, my God, I cannot tell if he is male or female.
Hmm.
What? I cannot tell. It's the person I'm looking at.
Hmm.
What's their gender? Oh, my God, what is going to happen to me?
Well,
we go ahead and we do it. Now, he's so, at this point, now it's 4 days later, he comes to the shoot in the green screen. He so doesn't want anybody in around him now. That he's at this point issued a command that we're at Raleigh Studios. There's about, I don't know, 18 various different sound stages there, right?
Right.
All the stages, when he goes from his RV to his studio, all the other stages are going to be under lockdown. Nobody's allowed to go in or out of those stages, the other ones, till he gets into our stage. When he gets in there, only allowing myself, the chief lighting technician, in case he has to adjust any lighting, the gaffer, Jim Bogard in this case, the grip, who is going to, the guy basically who's responsible for moving the camera. We do have a motion control rig there, but we have levers to enable us to human encode the movement of the camera as he moves around the stage. We're going to move the camera to pursue him or whatever to compose him as he moves around. I have remote control gear wheels, pan and tilt wheels to pan and tilt the camera, and the assistant is also allowed in there to pull focus and to work the zoom lens if need be. The director's not allowed in, the AD's not allowed in. It's one of the biggest stages in Hollywood. There's only the four, myself and three crew members, and Michael and one security guy come into this room. The director, the producer, everyone else, all of the vanity departments, the hair, wardrobe, makeup, etc., all are getting a video feed from our film camera, and they're in another room. They've hung a microphone in the middle of this big space that we're sort of yelling to speak to them, and they're speaking back to us over a microphone and, you know, a speaker system in the room. Well, Michael comes walking into the room with his security guy, and he starts speaking, and I'm looking at him. Who's he speaking to? I'm looking around. Who's in here? I mean, there's nobody in here. Who in the world is he speaking to? And then as I'm looking around, he goes, no, Daniel, he goes, it's okay, I'm speaking to you. He goes, I have to tell you something. He says, I've just seen that footage. He goes, I never, ever dreamed that I could look like that. He goes, from now on, you can speak to me.
Wow. He does look flawless in that video. It's incredibly beautiful video. But one more question I had to ask about that particular video, and then I'll let you off the hook. There's a lot of shots in there too of with his wife at the time.
Yeah.
What was that experience like shooting the two of them together?
Well, that was very interesting. I mean, I've been asked this question many times. Was she actually topless at the time? And she was. That's a question that's often asked. She was very cool to work with, and he was very much in love with her at the time, and he was very protective of to make sure that she was dealt with properly, and that it wasn't all about him; it was to be about the two of them. He was very very into her, and basically spent a lot of time, and some of the shots that are in there are actually shots we grabbed when they didn't even know we were rolling. They were interacting on that level.
It's a place like that.
Mm-hmm.
It does. Looking back at all of his extraordinary work in video, in music video,
mm-hmm.
Thriller and on Black and White and on and on and on, and of course mm-hmm. the incredible stuff that you did with him. What do you think his legacy is? How did he change the form in your perception?
Wow, I mean, in every way. The form being music videos or music. I mean, he's huge. I mean, in fact, when I invited Steve Barron to join us here, what I sent him, and I hadn't spoken to him in a few years. I sent him an email saying, Steve, I'm sure you've seen, you're aware of what's going on. The two videos that are being shown over and over again, and particularly Billie Jean, is usually starting off a lot of the news reports. And the two that are being shown over and over again are Billie Jean and Thriller. I said I'm sure you're aware how important video Billie Jean was to Michael Jackson as well as to the rest of the world.
Right.
And I really do feel like the man just changed everything. He changed everything there is about music, about dance, about fashion, style, certainly music videos. I mean, probably nobody's been as influential. I think we'll find he's gone beyond even Elvis, by a long shot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, Daniel, we love you on this show, and
thank you so much.
I can't let you go without congratulating you on Friday the 13th. We didn't get to talk to you on the heels of that.
Sorry.
What's coming up for you? Anything?
I forget where I was when you guys were trying to keep me on that. I'm sorry, I couldn't make it.
Although that's fine. That's fine.
Actually, I think I was in London with Andy Morahan shooting George Michael concert. I think is where I was. What's coming up for me? The world's in, we got a worldwide recession going on, so filmmaking slowed down. We're all of us working about a half of what we used to. Between the economic disaster and the things that were going on with the Screen Actors Guild and settling a contract, which they finally did ratify and agree on a contract a month or so ago. Film production, because I'm doing much more features these days, has been very slow. But I do have three or four horror films that people are talking to me about. They're all threatening to get going in August or September with the prep. So I hope to, in the next two or three weeks, settle that. The other thing that might be of interest to your viewers is I've reteamed with a director, Hype Williams, who I thought we did absolutely incredible work together during the 90s. And we teamed back up about 3 months ago. We went off and did Kanye West's video in Hawaii for Amazing. And then about 3 weeks ago, we did a new video for Puff Daddy called Angels.
Wow.
That hasn't been released yet. So it's quite interesting that it's shot in black and white. And it's not all flash and asses being shaken in your face. It's much more of a social commentary than that. We shot in the projects. We shot in, a lot. It was much more of a roots kind of a thing for Puffy,
mm-hmm.
where he's coming from than where he's been and where he's going.
Well, Well, I will watch anything that you're
really
behind.
Well, I think you'll find this is really beautiful black and white. I'm really happy that Hype and the colorist on this one, Jace Thierry, who is also one of the world's greatest colorists, who did the telecine. Between the three of us, the decision was not to push the look too stylized. Don't make it look like it's a flash music video. Go with the real true black and white of the Robert Frank or the great documentarians.
Right.
Go really use the power of black and white. I did the contrast alteration that I wanted with color filtration at the time of photography. I didn't want them to push it to any new places, and they didn't. And I think it's going to be really, really a good-looking video, and I think I'm going to be proud of it, although I have not seen the finished edit, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be great.
Well, we can't wait to see it, and please keep in touch with us.
I will. You guys do the same.
Thank you, Daniel. Have a good one.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Take it easy. Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, that's Daniel Pearl, the cinematographer of so many great music videos and films, including Michael Jackson's Billie Jean, Given to Me, and You Are Not Alone, three very impressive impressive works in and of themselves. Okay, we're ready for our last interview segment of the evening. And this is a very interesting conversation about Michael Jackson and about specifically the Captain EO experience and the feature film career that might have been. And the guest that we're speaking to now, his name is Rusty Limerand, and he's the producer of films like Yentl, and he wrote Electric Dreams, which is currently actually being remade. Plans are underway to remake Electric Dreams, which we just spoke about that movie last week.
Yes, we did.
Yeah, and this is a really fascinating interview. I hope you guys enjoy it. This is Rusty Limerand. Let me ask you first how this project came about for Captain EO.
I think the most important part was that Disney suddenly had new management. It's kind of well known that Michael Eisner, Frank Wells, and Jeffrey Katzenberg came over to Disney from Paramount and Warner Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was to re-energize Disney, which was not doing very well as a film studio. Sort of was separate from the rest of Hollywood. And one of the first things they decided was to integrate the various divisions. At that time, the theme park division was utterly distinct from the film division. And the three gentlemen I mentioned did a survey and thought, there's quite a bit of talent at the theme park division, particularly with, character design and animatronic design. And so the new management, Eisner, Katzenberg, and Wells, thought they could, in fact, use that team for special effects in films, et cetera.
Right.
That didn't work out very well. We found that out in Captain EO. But they also knew that both George Lucas and Michael Jackson were huge fans of the theme park. Lucas famously, as a college student, spent a lot of weekends there, wandering around, self-described nerd who felt comfortable there.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Jackson was famous for repeated visits in disguise, et cetera. So the three men I mentioned put their heads together and said, hey, we could do something very exciting for the park if we could get George Lucas and Michael Jackson to do an event,
right?
Some kind of attraction. And Disney already had an attraction there called Magic Journeys, which was a large format 3D short film, which was apparently very successful. I recall it was basically travel footage through mountains, through cities. It was an amusement park with carousels, etc.
Yeah.
But at that time, 3D, I basically disappeared. So the perfection of that system, because it was double 65mm cameras, at a time when if you saw 3D in a cinema, it was basically a 35mm print cut in half with two effectively 16mm images overlapped, so the quality was terrible. So they approached Michael and George, who were pretty excited about it, both loving new technology and trying new things. And the Disney theme park people came up with three premises for the ride, for the attraction. One was Michael would be on some kind of iced environment with a witch ice queen. It seemed to me it was kind of out of, you know, line, Witch in the Wardrobe. And he would combat that creature. Another was that Michael would stay in the park after night, after hours, and hide on the Pirates of the Caribbean ride. And so that would be the 3D adventure. And the third one was that Michael would be a space voyager who used music to, you know, turn bad and evil into good,
mm-hmm.
and would combat some wicked person, some kind of villain. Sorry.
That's okay.
And combat villain with music. So that's the one Michael liked. George liked that one. And that's where I entered the picture. Apparently George said, we need to find a producer-writer, someone who can work with celebrities, because Michael might be difficult. George had really no background with that. And George had a lot of other projects. So I had just finished Gentle, producing that, doing rights and writing on that. And I'd also written and produced a film called Electric Dreams, which had a lot of effects, et cetera. So Disney flew me in from Spain. I was actually researching a musical on the life of Goya. I was hustled in very quickly. It was all top secret. But I went up to Lucas Ranch, met with him. It was very exciting for me. And I think the main reason I got the job was I had been developing a feature film in 3D, a space film, which meant I had a lot of background, a recent background in 3D technology. And two, I had a history with Disneyland. I had done my senior thesis on a comparative study of Disneyland and Coney Island, how the theme park business had changed over those decades. And I said to him, I remember saying, hey, if Walt Disney were alive, he wouldn't just put a 3D movie in the theater, he'd put interactive theater effects.
Yeah.
And George said, what do you mean? And I said, well, you know, he'd have the seats move, and he'd have smoke when there's explosions, and he'd put stars in the walls, and he'd find every way that the 3D could become more dimensional, like,
mm-hmm.
kind of like a 4D effect. And George said, that's great, we got to do that, and you've got the job. So that began the process, and I recall the first meeting with Michael Jackson. I was very nervous and concerned that I would kill my shyness, because I knew from experience with Barbra Streisand that when you get to be that big a celebrity, you hate it when people don't look you in the eye, which
right.
few people do. And so I had been taught early on that you need to look a celebrity right in the eye, otherwise, sort of like an animal instinct, they feel you're not strong enough to work with them. It was easy because Michael always wore sunglasses at that time. For some reason, that was his style. I think it was to be in control, in a sense, that everybody had to look at him, but nobody knew if he was looking at them.
Mm.
And we kind of hit it off. We became very close friends. And partly because George was very busy with Howard the Duck at the time and the Ewok movie, and he was helping repair the sequel to The Wizard of Oz, which was in a lot of trouble that Disney had acquired,
mm-hmm.
and a couple of other projects. We didn't see much of him. We hadn't hired a director yet. In the classic sort of old studio style, we developed the project without knowing who our director would be, and there was an assumption that it would be a quick job, like a rock video.
Right.
Since it was only meant to be about 15 minutes, that, you know, it could be like a week shoot. George said, well, we'll ask Spielberg first. We have to give him the first opportunity, partly because Michael had a close relationship with him. Of course, George did. And he passed right away. And then George said, well, what about Francis? Of course, they were very close. That's kind of historically well documented. And Disney didn't want to do it. At that point, Francis, you know, was considered, I mean, he had all the problems with One from the Heart, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So they were very nervous about him. Michael raised concerns, saying, what does he know about rock videos? What does he know about special effects? Both of which were sort of at the heart of Captain EO. But I remember George saying, and I was quite impressed by it, he said, look, Francis is a bona fide artist. He's the real McCoy. And if you're a real artist, you can do anything. And George also, of course, gave the assurances that he would make sure that if Francis didn't deliver on some level, he would, you know, he would step in a sense. And so Francis was hired, but the script had already been written. I had written a first draft, which everybody seemed happy with. And but then, of course, Francis, like any writer-director, wanted to do his polish. But he didn't change much. It was mostly dialogue in the first half of the project, and if anyone's seen it.
Right.
It's basically two halves. There's the part in the spaceship where you meet the crazy stuffed animal characters that are Michael's team, Captain Eel's team. And then they get the distress call, and they land on the dark, sinister planet. And then the second half is meeting the Angelica Houston, which getting in trouble, getting out of trouble, using music and dance, and then
right.
the big dance sequence, and then, of course, the concluding dance sequence.
Coppola was recently interviewed, and he gave a statement about Michael Jackson and said that there was such a childlike glee and excitement to him on that set. Did you find that to be the case?
Absolutely. And the secret of working with Michael was to literally think, how would you deal with, you know, a 10-year-old boy? And Francis got it. I mean, at one point, I remember this distinctly, he was having trouble directing Michael. Michael didn't seem to respond to the kind of normal word dialogue that a director largely uses. And Francis is brilliant at it. I mean, he has a wonderful way with actors, but it wasn't working. So he literally sent out for some masks, happy masks like clown masks and scary masks. And when he wanted to elicit an emotion from Michael, he would literally put on one of the masks, and it would be as if a child were reacting to a mask.
Yeah.
And it was effective. I mean, I'm not saying that was every moment, but it was certainly there were moments. I mean, in some ways, I don't think Francis used that technique enough. Because he used to say to me, I'm not getting through to Michael. He seems to have such a rapport with you. And what can I do? And I was a little embarrassed. I said, well, you need to go out with him and go toy shopping. You need to hang out with him and play some video games. Because that was basically how I got to know him. He loved to go toy shopping. But then the adult in him wanted to drive his car. And he drove like a maniac. I mean, a very effective driver. But I was always, like, gripping my seat. And he had masks. He loved to have masks in his glove compartment, which he would put on as he drove. And his explanation was, well, if I don't put it on, people will see it's me and they'll chase me.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, well, if you put a gorilla mask on or something in the car, they might chase you for that reason. I sense he just enjoyed it. He just really enjoyed the playfulness of it. Then we go into a toy store. He had his favorites, and I knew most of them. I kind of collect old toys. So some of them were collectible toy stores. He loved The Last Wound Up on Melrose Avenue, for example. And it was funny because then he would wear a mask. The mask he'd wear into the store would usually be like a woman's harem mask kind of thing,
right,
with a veil across his face. So it was always very awkward for me that I'd go in there and they'd look at me like, who are you with this sort of unidentified harem man, because Michael was very tall and very, he had a very mannish body, and his hands were huge, and he walked, with a very confident mannish way, but then he'd have this girl's harem mask on, so I kept thinking, oh my God, if they only knew, they'd stop staring at me as this weirdo who walked around with this guy. But that was the secret, and when I'd meet at his house, it was in Encino at the time, where his parents still live, which was like a miniature version of what later became Neverland, with twinkling lights and all the trees and animated displays and windows and a small zoom in the back. We would often meet in his bedroom, which was so huge it was really more like a suite. It was like could be like a house for some people. But he had paintings of Walt Disney and endless shelves of toys and mannequins and video games. And If you dealt with him on that level, the communication was ideal.
Mm.
But if you tried to deal with him like an adult, he wasn't rude and he wasn't difficult. It just was clear it wasn't getting to his heart, so to speak.
Right.
but that way. So I've always felt that the portrayal of Michael as a young man in an adult body was not a creation. It was actually genuine and true. On the other hand, if there was a tough business decision, and there were a few, he could become an adult very quickly. It was almost like a split personality, a little spooky in that way.
He would have to.
It was a switch, and you literally see his eyes switch. I mean, it was a little spooky, as I said. You see a change in his face, and he'd suddenly become an adult, and he'd deal with the adult matter, the legal matter, the business matter, and then kind of revert back to the child.
Did you have any run-ins with him after the Captain EO experience?
Yeah, I knew him for the subsequent 25-some years. He really enjoyed the process we had, and we got very, very close during post-production because the thing had a lot of problems in the shooting. It wasn't just a weak shoot. It wasn't enough. It was one of those things that kind of got saved in post-production.
Yeah.
But also, George Lucas pointed out most of his projects, which are so special effects dependent, the first cuts are pretty disastrous.
Yeah.
He told that to his staff. He said, if you'd seen the first cut of Indiana Jones, if you'd seen the first cut of Star Wars, you'd think it was a bomb. And the first cut of Captain EO, we kind of thought it would be cut very quickly because it was only, again, 15 minutes. But it was one of the longest post-production schedules I've ever been part of. And part of the problem was it really had to be a rock video.
Mm-hmm.
And it was shot much more in a grand kind of a theatrical style. And there just weren't enough cuts. There weren't enough edits and a lot of other issues. So there was a tremendous amount of additional shooting. Francis had already gone on to another film. The contract we had with him is we only had him for 2 weeks because he already had signed to do Peggy Sue Got Married.
Uh-huh.
So literally they monitored him on the set the last few days and took him away. And so all the post was done sort of like, again, the old style movies where a director comes in, he directs the actors, and then you go off with your editors and your special effects people and your producer, in this case me. But Michael got very involved in that process, and I used to bring him cuts, and he'd get happier. He was very upset initially, and he said, this is what happens when you have, you know, a director really needs to know pop promos and TV videos, whatever you want to call them. But as we added all these shots and did the reshooting and cut the thing and, you know, started using shots in ways they weren't intended, as post-production allows, you can flip them, you know, and mirror them, and you can sometimes use a tail of a shot where an actor moves and you didn't, you know, you thought it was cut. It's amazing what you can do in post if you open your mind to that. And he was very involved in post-production. And he claimed that that's, in fact, what he had done on Thriller and also on Bad, where he felt the things had really emerged in the post-production process.
Mm.
So then Michael was pretty pleased with our relationship. And he had just set up his film company at Sony, Columbia. And the problem was with all the development people, et cetera, and it was a pretty thick company with people, he wasn't committing to anything. And I think people just really didn't understand how to react, you know, how to relate to him, how to make him understand what a film could be, and I think also finding the right films. Because I used to say to him, you're a little bit like Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know, you can't do any part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the part has to be tailored to you. He became a star because of Terminator, you know, famously a part that they didn't think he was right for. They wanted him to play the good guy. He said, no, I don't speak English that well. I need to play the bad guy. And, of course, the rest is history. So Michael said, well, you come up with some ideas. And I came up with two fairly quickly. One was to remake an old film called The Seven Faces of Dr. Lau,
mm-hmm.
which was an old Tony Randall film that involved a child protagonist. It's basically a Pied Piper story where a weird guy who takes on seven different personalities through animation, et cetera, comes to a small town with a circus. And the other was to remake the film Angels with 30 Faces, which is basically a James Cagney film. Michael was a huge James Cagney fan, who has a gang of kids and again, a famous film that's been parodied and, in a sense, remade in many ways. And Michael loved both projects. Part of it was the way I explained it to him and talked him through it. And we had sketches done on one and creatures made. You really had to sort of turn it into the toy version. On Dr. Lau, we had set miniatures built of the circus. And he committed to both, which was a major event at the time, that Michael would actually commit to projects.
Hmm.
And one was set up at Warner's, and the other was set up at Turner, who owned the remake rights. And everything was going great. Fantastic. We were going to have two films with Michael. And then the first scandal hit. I remember as vividly as I remember, you know, where I was when I heard President Kennedy was shot.
Yeah.
I was in my car driving to the small studio where we were building these miniatures, where people were going to come and actually see them. And someone called me and said, did you hear what's on the news? Michael Jackson's ranch has been raided. That was the first accusation.
Hmm.
And if you recall, Michael was quickly on his way to Japan for the first stop on his tour. And they sent me to Japan to bring the miniatures. They were very concerned that he was deeply depressed and that if he saw these miniatures, if he saw these toys, which were quite wonderful, I mean, they really were brilliantly executed and perfect for describing to him in, again, this childlike way what this film could be. But they said this is to kind of keep him positive, because right now he's thinking his world is over.
Yeah.
And I flew there, and that's a long story in itself, what happened when I got there, but it worked the charm. He couldn't have been more delighted and happy and committed. But the truth of the matter is, put very simply, you know, and in fairness to Hollywood and the big studios, they have huge investment obligations to their shareholders. So they got very nervous. They didn't know if the audience would still be there for Michael.
Yeah.
So all the excitement about making films with him, where at that time if Michael committed to a film, any studio would have jumped, as they did with the two projects he committed to, the two that I brought to him, suddenly nobody wanted to touch him. And it wasn't like forever. It was, well, we'll wait and see what happens. Because,
mm-hmm.
of course, at that time it was a serious allegation. You may recall he never showed up in Mexico. The assumption was he was going to be arrested there. Whether that's true or not, he didn't show up for his Mexico concert. He suddenly disappeared, and for a month nobody knew where he was. He was calling me repeatedly during that time. I knew he was in Europe because he'd joke and say, the sun is just coming up. He wouldn't tell me where he was. I didn't press the matter. But he'd say, the sun is just coming up, and it would be a certain time in L.A., so I knew that that was European time.
Hmm.
And to put it briefly, the Warner's Brother project ended completely, but then he acquired the rights, partial rights, to Dr. Lowe. That's a complicated... I mean, a lot of times films don't get made because of complex underlying rights problems. You may know that Spider-Man, for example, for years was tied up in bankruptcy court.
Yeah.
James Cameron was going to direct it. So there were Dr. Lowe problems because the rights were co-owned by George Powell, who made the original film, and, well, it turned out Turner, because they had acquired the library. So why Dr. Lowe never gave me? But we hired Stan Winston, and we had music commissioned and written by Giorgio Moroder. It was quite exciting, and, you know, I have to tell you quite sad that it never happened, because it was very important for Michael to be in movies. He used to talk about Elvis Presley's career and say, you know, if Elvis hadn't made all his films, he wouldn't be as remembered as he was, and he really wanted a film career.
What kind of film career do you think he could have had without all of these complications that arose?
Well, he would have made Dr. Lowe, and it could have been another Grease. You know, I think it would have been remarkable. It was a wonderful story. And if any of your listeners watched the old movie and imagine an updated version, we set it in inner city and modernized it. If you look at Angels, Dirty Faces and imagine a musicalized version of that, you'll see. And all it takes is two or three hits to have a film career, so to speak.
Right.
I mean, for all we talk about Schwarzenegger or Barbra Streisand or even Brad Pitt, you know, it's Tom Cruise, it's usually two or three hits and all the rest of good movies, but not.
And he was already the biggest star on the planet. So, I mean, he had that going for him before he even entered the filmmaking world.
I think it's a global tragedy that it never happened. Because, of course, one reason we remember Marilyn Monroe and Judy Garland and James Dean is because of their movies that live on forever.
Yeah.
So
it's
a very personal tragedy for me, and I think the world lost something that they'll never know.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, and then I'll let you go. You've been so generous to give of your time today to us. When you heard that he had passed, what were your initial thoughts, and what were your thoughts on what the world has lost with that talent?
Well, two things surprised me. One was how sad I was, because I liked Michael a lot, and I felt I was part of a group he trusted and respected, and any time I wanted to see him, it would take a few days to get the meeting arranged, but sometimes he'd fly me in to see him. I flew all over the world during those 20 years meeting with him, because that was easier for him than waiting until he was in L.A. And I, you know, as an adult, I don't think I ever was a close friend. I think you really had to be young to be that close, but in the sense I would bring out whatever I could remember of my youth and speak on that level, I think we were pretty close. But I was surprised how much I felt a loss, almost like a family member. And then I noticed how everyone was feeling a loss. And it struck me that, you know, a funny thing happens in a world culture. We bond with our celebrities in ways we don't even recognize. I mean, I had gotten so used to, if someone heard that I'd worked with Michael, I'd hear all the negativity, and all the pessimism, and all the insinuations from anybody, young or old. You know, and I defend him to the extent I could. I mean, I only knew what I knew, and I never saw any signs of inappropriate behavior. And I believe in our legal system, and he was acquitted, so he should be treated like an acquitted individual. But it just wore me down. And then suddenly, he passes away, and it's almost like the world forgets all that and is reminded how much he contributed to their lives and how magical his existence made us feel about, you know, the potential for human beings. So I'm just really impressed and a little bit stunned at the broad public warmth and sadness.
Yeah.
I'd never seen that before. And then finally, I felt a very personal failure. I mean, as much as I tried to get these films made, and there are a couple of others not with not as much time dedicated, I kept thinking, what could I have done? You know, where could I have pushed a little harder, made a few more phone calls? Because it wasn't easy working with Michael, and this is going to come out more and more. He kept changing management. I don't think he was that trusting. Mm-hmm. And every time you have a new management, you have to, as a producer-writer, you have to start all over again, winning them over. Convincing them the project is valid. And each time he had a new group, I could do that, but it was difficult. And he almost wished it were the old Hollywood system where the star was on contract and they were just told what to do. Because Michael, you know, could have made, I'm repeating myself here, but he should have made 3 or 4 movies.
Yeah.
It's a loss to him. It was very important to him. He talked about it constantly. And I think it lost to society and culture.
It really is, and you know, I'm as a 35-year-old man. I was those were formative years when he came around, when he really blew up in the early mid '80s, and I feel like that chunk of my kind of childhood innocence is, you know, it's gone in a way. It's difficult for me to express, but it really did draw upon a lot of sadness for me as well when I heard Thursday.
I'm not surprised to hear that, because I think we all felt that without realizing the potential. But until somebody's gone, whether it's family member or friend, you don't really realize what they meant to you. I'm just stunned and so impressed that the world feels that loss. It's really a testimony to him.
Okay, that was Rusty LaMorand talking about the film career that almost was of Michael Jackson.
Wow.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Yeah, it was. talk about how different things would be. Wow, that's just... It's one of those great what-ifs.
I remember hearing about him wanting to do an Edgar Allan Poe project for a long time, too. You remember that?
Yes, I do. I remember there was lots of talk before everything went south. I mean... there was a lot of talk about him wanting to do movies, and I thought after The Wiz, you know, I thought that would have been there would have been more of that.
But I think, too, and coupled with what Daniel had to say about how he interacted with his directors and the trust issues and all of that, I don't know at that stage of his life, after he blew up the way he did, if he would have been able to seize the reins to it. I mean, I didn't have that perception until hearing Daniel speak and Jackson's relationship with Coppola as well. But it would have been an interesting journey.
Yes, it would have been. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts you want to share on? We try to focus on the movie element of the motion picture element and the media element of what Michael Jackson was, being the kind of show we are. But
yeah.
Was he a big part of your life too?
I think that like everyone, Thriller was a big part, like in junior high and high school. And then as I got older in high school, you know, the music just diminished for me. But you know, there's no denying, Thriller was like for many people, my Generation X especially, was like the first big. I mean, remember, going back to the film thing, this is John Landis, if I'm not mistaken, directed Thriller. So
oh,
that
yeah.
was a big, big deal. I remember the first time that came on Friday Night Videos. I actually saw it in Florida, of all places, in Palm Beach, during a Christmas vacation when that premiered, and that was like nothing I'd ever seen before. So, and I was, I think, 13 at the time.
Yeah.
So that was that was something. And that, you know, that album is one of those, you know, I don't care who you are, what kind of music you like, that's a, you know, just an incredible groundbreaking album.
You know, I think that, I think that much of Thriller, Bad, and Dangerous is exemplary.
Yeah.
And Landis, you know, he did obviously Thriller, which changed the culture.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about something that everybody was wearing the red. Well, that was Beat It. Everybody wore the red zipper jackets and.
Oh yeah, that was very big when I was when I was in junior high and especially high school, 9th and 10th grade. Everyone had that.
Yeah, but
everyone also
Landis did Black and White, which
mm-hmm.
was the most expensive music video at that time, and I think it's even still,
mm-hmm.
was Black and White. And rewatching these videos, they're incredibly impressive.
Oh, yeah, this stuff still holds up very well. I mean, like I said at the start of the show, I mean, he really, you know, set the gold standard of what you do, music video and everything, how they're made, with the dance, especially the dance moves. And that's all him. You see it every
yeah.
day. I don't care what you're watching. There's a little bit of Michael, his influence in all of these things.
Martin Scorsese's Bad.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really these mini movies, as
yeah.
we were discussing before. So it is a great loss. And as one of our friends in the chat room says, his videos were always cinematic. And
mm-hmm,
just another one of his legacies that he leaves behind.
Yes. It's a shame, and it's such a. I mean, last week, we lost. I mean, just that one day, Thursday, just a horrible day. Farrah Fawcett in the morning, and then Michael Jackson, and then that really shocked. I had no idea about that one. That just caught me, really knocked the wind out of me.
Mm-hmm. And then Ed McMahon days prior, and
yeah, mm-hmm.
and today Billy Mays Hayes passed away.
Billy Mays, yes.
And if you think about it. With Farrah Fawcett and Michael Jackson, two icons of their time.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, they're gone now.
Mm-hmm.
But the music will live on, and the work will live on, certainly. And speaking of leaving behind, we're going to be gone until July 8th.
That's right. We
and
have
we'll
a big, big show. We have a very big show planned.
Yeah, Ashby retrospective and Jeremy Renner, who's the star of the new movie Hurt Locker.
Right.
Fantastic movie. This is a great movie. And you've been hearing it all over the place that
this is
one
like
of the
really
major...
the first well very well reviewed film of the year, universally praised.
Yeah, and to limit it as kind of an Iraq themed movie is kind of limited because it could be about people with a difficult job in any environment, but it is among the Iraq centered films. It stands head and shoulders above.
Mm-hmm. It sounds that way. Definitely.
It's very exciting. So we'll be back with you guys on July 8th, and we appreciate everyone tuning in tonight.
Yes, thank you,
Jerry. We'll see you next time.
Okay. Take care. Good night, everyone.
Good night, everybody.